This sermon is from the series Esther, Trusting the Unseen God, preached at Crossway Church in Battleground, Washington.
When have you been caught off by a plot twist? Maybe you're a voracious reader and you're reading the mystery and you thought to yourself, man, I didn't see that one coming. Or you're watching a movie or a series and the authors write a twist that completely catches you off guard. As I was thinking about this, I don't remember what the show was, but I remember one time telling Steph in the last month going, there is no way I saw that coming. And I like to pride myself that I like to kind of figure stuff out. Well, why do I start off my sermon talking about a plot twist? Because the book of Esther is going to be full of them. That's actually kind of the point of the book of Esther, is there are these upcoming plot twists. And sometimes we can read through things so quickly, or the pastor can break things up in a way that we miss them. And so today, even though we're going to be looking at Esther 3, 1 through 15, all of chapter 3, I'm going to start in Esther 2, verse 19, because I want you to catch the plot twist. At least see if you can figure it out. It's pretty easy to kind of miss, but there is one embedded in there. So we're going to do like we have done the last couple of weeks, because we're looking at a bigger chunk of scripture, and I'm going to read a chunk, and then we're going to unpack it, and then read the next. So keep your Bibles open, but we'll be looking at Esther 3. If you have your own Bibles, we read the NIV. Obviously, there's maybe some spots where it's a little bit different if you have a different translation, but you can also read in the pews in front of you. If you want sermon notes, they are in our bulletin, in that worship sheet, and also you can see via the YouVersion app. But this is the word of the Lord. When the virgins were assembled a second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. But Esther had kept secret her family background and nationality, just as Mordecai had told her. For she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions as she had done when he was bringing her up. During the time Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, and Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, became angry and conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. And when the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were impaled on poles, and all of this was recorded in the book of the annals in the presence of the king. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, king of Hammedatha, the Agite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor, higher than all of the other nobles. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay honor. And then the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command?" Day after day they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. Therefore they told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated, for he had told them he was a Jew. Now, I kind of set it up, so maybe you saw the plot twist there. It's not quite like the whodunits, where it's like you expect this person is the murderer, and it ends up being this one. But it is a shocking twist nonetheless. See, as I said, the passage starts it off, and it starts off in bringing two events together. And the author of Esther wants to set this up. He highlights it by saying, after these events, right there in 3:1. And those events are that Mordecai had just spared King Xerxes' life. Now, if ever somebody should get promoted or receive something, you would think it would be the person who would save the king's life, right? I mean, that should be the expectation. But that's not what happened. Instead, the author of Esther says that Haman is promoted. After these events, after Mordecai did everything he could to protect the king and to show that he was a faithful servant to him and to do everything he could in that regards, it says that he receives nothing but two lines in the annals of the king. And instead, Haman is promoted and he is looked over or passed over. And so we should sit here with this kind of feeling of, why is this? I mean, this isn't the way the world works. If you do a good, you should get promoted for that. But the reality is what we see here is that Mordecai gets passed over and Haman is promoted. Now, we don't know why Haman got promoted. We'll see later in the chapter that he seems to be filthy rich, quite frankly. He says to the king that he will give over hundreds of pounds of silver, or tons of silver, to the king, and if he does what he wants. And so obviously Haman is wealthy, and maybe that has something to do with it. But you would think that at least Mordecai would get some kind of response other than it being written in the annals of the king. Now, what we see here soon is that Mordecai is passed over, and we see that happening. Now, his response is not great. We see that in this section as well. He refuses to bow down to Haman. I don't know if he's angry. I don't know if he's mad and frustrated that he didn't get the promotion that he wanted. But even though the king commanded it, when we see that very clearly said in the text, Mordecai refuses to bow down. And he uses his Jewish roots as the excuse. Now, I'm pretty careful in my language here of saying it's an excuse, because in all the other places, Mordecai actually hides his ethnicity. I mean, he commands Esther, after all, that she shouldn't do that. And in this section too, we see that all the other Jews bowed down and showed respect. And so this isn't a Daniel 3 situation where the king says that if you need to bow down to an idol, a big statue, and worship it, this is more a bow of respect. And so it doesn't seem that this is something that all the Jews are, that this is a Jewish custom and that he's just going with it, but rather it seems like it's a more of a personal thing. And we see, again, that Mordecai has kept his nationality secret because it served his purpose. And so it seems that he doesn't pull this card out until the royal officers give him such a hard time for not bowing and asking him that finally he almost gives it as an excuse. It's like, well, I'm Jewish, as if that should just kind of let him be. But there's a bigger story going on here, and it's easy for us to miss, and that is that Haman and Mordecai are fighting like their ancestors. Now, I say this because everything in the Bible has a purpose. And if you looked in Esther 2, we saw that the author of Esther actually had listed a genealogy, kind of a mini genealogy, and had given names. And one of the things that we saw is that Mordecai was a descendant of a Benjamin tribe and of Saul's father. And so the author wanted us to see that Mordecai was probably a descendant of Saul. And then what we saw here in Esther 3 is that the author highlights that Haman is an Agite. Now again, we have to go back to 1 Samuel 15, but what we see is that Saul attacked the Amalekites and then Agag was the king. And so the Jewish readers of this, when they saw these ancestries and these things, would have put it together. There's a little bit of foreshadowing. It would be like if we were doing a movie of the 1860s in the spot where the Hatfields and the McCoys were, and you saw their names, you knew that even though when these two people burst onto the scene, that there was going to be a battle. Or if you're a Shakespeare's fan, you know that if there's the Montague and the Capulets, other than Romeo and Juliet, that adds the drama, right? That there was going to be this battle. Well, the same is true in the book of Esther. When we see a descendant of Saul and a descendant of Agag coming together, we can expect that there's going to be conflict. And we see the beginnings of it right here in this text when Mordecai refuses to bow down to Haman. Well, what's Haman's reaction going to be? We'll find out soon in Esther 3, verse 5 through 11. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing Mordecai only. Instead, Haman looked for ways to destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. Then in the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan, the Pur, that is the lot, was cast in the presence of Haman to select a day and a month. Now, I realize that some of your translations, if you have the ESV or some of those, have it that he's actually casting it this long. The Hebrew's a little bit murky in this, but I think this works with it and is accurate. The lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. And then Haman said to King Xerxes, "There are certain people dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom who keep themselves separate. Their customs are different from those of all other people, and they do not obey the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let the decree be issued to destroy them. I will give you 10,000 talents of silver to the king's administrators for the royal treasury. So the king took his signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha, Agite, the enemy of the Jews. Keep the money, the king said, Haman, and do with the people as you please. Well, we saw what Haman's reaction was, and it's usually what happens. It's almost comical the way that the author of Esther sets this up. It's like Haman went through and had all these people bowing down to him, and he's so self-absorbed that he didn't even notice that Mordecai wasn't bowing down to him until the royal officers come and asked him if it's okay. I mean, that's the way the narrative is set up. But once he finds out, he is angry and he is enraged, because he was all about prestige and honor. As we've seen, that is a theme that we see all the Persian leaders have. We saw that with Xerxes, where he had to throw the big, huge party to show how rich he was and wealthy he was. How when Vashti went against his command, how he was enraged and had this anger against it, because you can't have somebody not do what the king says. And so we see that the same kind of anger is there in Haman. But the text is clear that what should have been just a personal thing, not all the Jews didn't bow down to Haman. It was just Mordecai. It was a personal thing. But his hatred grew, and it went beyond Mordecai to all of the people. And so his hatred spread not just to Mordecai, but to all of the Jewish people. And we see here that he scorned the idea of only killing Mordecai, but he wanted instead to wipe out all of his people. Now, that is a pretty big leap, don't you think? I mean, one person does you wrong, and you want to wipe out the entire nation. We see that his hatred just is intense, and there's a fire in it that needs to be squelched and can only be squelched with revenge and blood. Now, there's an irony here, too, because if you look at the entire part of 1 Samuel 15, you'll notice that that's actually what Saul was commanded to do, and he refused to do it. But what we see here is that Haman's anger decides that he's going to create a plan, and he divides a plan. And I use that word very carefully, because the way that the author of Esther sets it up is he wants us to realize that Haman wants to make sure that the gods are looking down on him. The Persian gods and the gods of his culture, he wanted to make sure that they were in agreement with his plan, and so he rolled the dice, the pur, which are basically clay dice like we have, and determine what the gods might think is the best day and the best month for this to happen. Now, once he has this plan and it's clear to him, he goes to Xerxes and he gets his permission to commit genocide. That's what it is. I mean, there's no other way to get around it. He gets Xerxes' permission to completely eradicate the Jews. Now, here's the thing. He does what is often we do in these situations. He paints the picture in a way that's favorable to him. The truth is that it's only Mordecai that is not obeying the king. It's only Mordecai that isn't bowing down to him. But he sets them up in a bigger scope of things, right? He says all of these people are different and all of them do not obey. And he incites the same kind of anger, or at least the response that he wants from the king. Now, you got to kind of think that King Xerxes here is eradicating his own power. It seems like in every spot we get to, he doesn't quite know what to do, and so he leans on others for advice and gets completely terrible advice. And in this case, King Xerxes literally takes the signet ring, which is his official seal, that what's written there is his own words, and he gives it to Haman and says, "You take care of it. You write it up. And all this money you promise, I don't really need it. Don't worry about it. Take care of it. You don't need to do that. You can have it on your own. But get rid of these people and take care of them." When we ended last week, we saw that Esther was afraid to share her nationality, or at least Mordecai didn't want her to do. And in this chapter, we see that Mordecai shares his nationality, and all of a sudden this thing blew up to where it's haunting him. And here's where we sit, is that the king has now threatened to kill all Jews, including his queen, and take them out a few months later. And so what we see in the last section of our scripture is that the edict goes out. A genocidal edict goes out. Then on the, here at Esther 3, verse 12. Then on the 13th day of the first month, the royal secretaries were summoned. They wrote out in the script of each province and in the language of each people all of Haman's orders to the king's satraps, the governors of the various provinces, and the nobles of the various principals. These were written in the name of King Xerxes himself and sealed with his own ring. Dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children, on a single day. The 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of that text of the edict was to be issued as a law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality so they would be ready for that day. The couriers went out, spurred on by the king's command, and the edict was issued in the city of the citadel of Susa. The king and Haman sat and down to drink, but the city of Susa was in bewildered. So an edict goes out, and it says that in about 11 months from now, what's going to happen is every single one of you are going to be able to eradicate the Jews, plunder them, kill them, take everything for themselves. It honestly is not quite different than what the Jews experienced in under the Nazi occupation, when similar kind of attitudes and actions were taken. But the scene ends with a difference. There's two people in different positions. In one scene, there's the king and Haman having a celebratory drink. Haman, after all, is angry, and vengeance is the only thing that could squelch it. And he has convinced the king to get on his plan and to wipe out an entire nation. And so his goals, his dreams, his anger, and his bitterness is appeased. And so he encourages the king to have a drink with him, and he's delighted. But it says that the people are bewildered. You can only imagine what's going through the minds of the Jews in particular, but even all of the province, the people of Susa, because this action is not very much like the Persians. There are other ruthless groups, and they were, the Persians were ruthless, but one thing that they did is they seemed to actually engage and allow other cultures to survive. It is, after all, Cyrus and Darius, the grandfather and father of Xerxes, that sent the Jews back to Jerusalem and gave them money to rebuild the city and the temple to allow them to worship their God in their way. And so this would have been unsettling a little bit to the people because it went against the norm. But of course, it would have been completely unsettling to the Jews to sit there and wonder what's going to happen to them for 11 months. Can you imagine that? You get an edict that says 11 months from now, you are going to be completely wiped out and eradicated, and everything you have is going to be destroyed. That is where we sit at the end of the chapter. A chapter where it seems like there's no hope, where there's a dark future awaiting the Jews, and nothing but frustration and bewilderment and fear, I am sure. But the author of Esther wants us to have a very small slimmer of hope. And it's easy for us to glance over it because it's in conversations about dates, but these Jews got the edict of King Xerxes on the day before the Passover lambs were slaughtered. It says in this text that it was on the 13th day of the first month. Well, Passover, the lambs were slaughtered on the 14th day in Nisan, which is the first day of the Jewish calendar. And so it would be literally like Christians getting a notice, this notice of genocide, before Christmas or Easter. But Passover, if you remember, is the time when the Jews remembered God's salvation from a brutal dictator in Egypt. And so on one end, it feels like the Jews are right there in that same spot where they have this brutal dictator who is once again raining down his fury and his anger on them. This time it's driven by Haman. Before, it was driven by Pharaoh. But as they celebrate it, I'm sure they're wondering, Where is God in all of this? Is he really going to save his people? But Passover would have been a reminder to them that God has saved them from the past, and there is the potential for him to save them again. And so it would have been this bittersweet day. On one end, they would have been wondering, where is God in all of this? I mean, God saved us from the Egyptians. We aren't supposed to go through this again. We're only supposed to have redemption and peace. But we're exiled again, and now as we're in exile, we have a ruthless ruler raining down on us again. But on the flip side, it would have been a very subtle reminder to them that the God who was faithful to them and his plan in the past would be faithful again to them in the future. And so celebrating Passover would have given them a little bit of sense of hope. And so that's where we sit here at the end of chapter 3 with a very dark and ominous cloud. For those of you who grew up in the Midwest like me, it's like the skies are completely green and you know there's a tornado on the horizon. Destruction is going to be coming your way, but there's also the sliver of sunshine off in the distance. And you wonder, which is going to win? Is that green cloud going to go this way and avoid you and you're going to get the clear skies? Or will it produce this tornado that you may not be able to survive? That's where we sit, a cliffhanger right there. Well, how does this passage apply to us? I mean, it's about a guy who's ticked off at somebody who won't bow. I mean, what does this really have to do with us? Well, I think there's a few things that we can learn from this passage. The first is how sin works. I mean, sin often snowballs. James says, desire gives way to sin, gives way to death. And that's often how sin works. We see it here in Haman. He's mad at one individual, and that grows as he doesn't squelch it and blows up into this entire thing where he's now angry at entire people, and he wants vengeance, is going to destroy them. And this is often the way sin works in our own lives. It starts off small. One simple lie that grows into a whole huge story that we have to do to cover up that one lie. But this is the way that we see the effects of sin. It starts off small, often snowballs, and gets bigger, as we see in the story of Haman. We also see that our righteous deeds will often go overlooked by earthly powers. I mean, Mordecai deserved more than just being probably having his name written in the annals that we see there. But even though he did the right thing, and even though he did what he could do to protect the king, went above and beyond, probably even put himself at somewhat risk of ratting on other people and getting them in trouble, it goes pretty much unnoticed other than two lines in the book. And what we need to see is that when we're in a culture that's actually about honor and power and prestige and looks, that sometimes when we do the right thing, it will go often overlooked. And we may not get the applause or the praise that we want. And so we shouldn't be caught off guard by that. We also see that tolerance has its limits. I mean, of all the empires of their day, the Persians, like I said, were some of the most tolerant ones. As I said, Cyrus and Darius were the ones who sent the Jews who were exiled earlier back so they could set up the temple and they could rebuild Jerusalem. And here, all of a sudden, when tolerance goes against the ideas of Haman and what he wants to accomplish, and his honor and his kind of being is threatened, well, then tolerance goes out the window. And I think that we live in a tolerant society, but we shouldn't be surprised sometimes that when we live differently, especially as we go against the cultural winds of our day, that there's a backlash there, that there's a kind of a sense of negativity about us. And so we shouldn't be caught off guard by that, because that is actually the story of God's people. And so I say that not to try and make it dark, I guess. Maybe it is. But rather to help us see that actually what we're experiencing today and what we go through is what God's people have gone through the ages. And so I think it's important for us to see this, that it's not just in today, but it's something that we see throughout. But I also want us to end with hope. Because if there's anything that the book of Esther reminds us of, it's that even when things seem dark, and even when things seem difficult, when in this case the entire Jewish race is threatened, what we're going to see at the end of the story is that God rules and he wins. And again, in this text and in throughout this book, it doesn't feel like God's there because God's name isn't even called upon. But yet what we're going to see is that every single detail in this story, including Mordecai being in the annals, God is going to use to ultimately continue his plan of redemption and bring about salvation. And so in this moment, the Jews, all they see is darkness, and all they feel is the threats and the pain and the suffering around them. But the truth of the matter is this, that there is still hope because God is the one who's in charge and he has a plan even when we don't see it. And so I think that that Passover and those dates there are put there as a foreshadow to us and a reminder to the foreshadow to the Jewish readers and a reminder to us that God is faithful and has been faithful in the past. And his plan of redemption will continue even when we don't see it. And that can give us hope, and that can give us strength, and that can give us peace. Now, we may not celebrate the Passover, but we celebrate the Lord's Supper or communion or the Eucharist, depending on what your background is. And if there is ever a time when we see that when dark clouds are surrounding, God's light can burst in, it is on the cross. I mean, read what Peter says. He says in Pentecost Day in Acts 2, he says, "Fellow Israelites, listen to this. Jesus of Nazareth was a man accredited by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs, which God did among you and through him. And as you yourselves know, but this man was handed over to you by God's deliberate plan and foreknowledge with you, the help of wicked men. You put him to death by nailing him on the cross." And then there's a big but. "God raised him from the dead, freeing him from the agony of death because it was impossible for death to keep its hold on him." And so in those moments when we feel the pain, when we feel the suffering, when we feel the weight of everything that is around us, and it doesn't just have to be cultural, it can be feeling the weight of health issues, it can be feeling the weight of emotional issues, relational issues, you name it, any of those things can feel like those dark clouds are overwhelming. The truth of Scripture is this, that the same God that brought life to us through faith in Jesus Christ will give us the strength and the power that we need to see that future day coming when Christ's plan of redemption will achieve its completion and evil and sin will be eradicated when Christ comes again. That is what our hope is. And that is what the story of Esther points to. When we are in those dark moments, when we feel like God is not at work, God is still there, and he rules, and he wins. And so rather than celebrating Passover, we celebrate the Lord's Supper to remind us that God can use even the most darkest of days to bring about his redemption, not only to us, but to the world around us. Let's pray.
You have just watched a sermon from Crossway Church in Battleground, Washington. We hope that you enjoyed it, and we'd love to have you come join us for a worship service on Sunday at 10 a.m. at 311 North Parkway Avenue in Battleground, Washington. If you'd like to find more information about us online, you can find it at crosswaychurchwa.com.